The hour of 10:15 having arrived, we will call the House Tax Committee to order. When we have a quorum, we will be moving, when we have a quorum, House File 893, and there are two amendments that we'll take up when we have a quorum. So with that being said, we're very happy to have Commissioner Bowery with us today and Mr. Cummings from the department. And so they'll be presenting the bill. If you look at the agenda, members, you see that it's the only bill on for today, and we're going to hear from the department, and then we will be taking members' questions as we go. And then what we will do is we will have testimony, and we have two stopwatches up here that are synchronized because we're going to check, recheck, and double-check 2 minutes because we have a whole bunch of people here to testify. So 2 minutes from the folks here that wish to testify. Is there anyone on the list of testifiers that lives more than 50 miles from the campus here of the state capitol? Okay, so if for some reason we need to go into another day, we would do that. We would just have people go to another meeting. So with that being said, is there anyone else? You've seen the agenda, or hopefully you've seen the agenda. Is there anyone else who should testify on behalf of the chairman's bill or with concerns thereof? Okay, so if somebody would come in and want to testify, just have them get a note up to Ms. Windsor here, and we will try to accommodate as best we can. So with that, members, we do not have a quorum yet, but we will start with the bill. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourselves for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Cynthia Bowerly. I'm the Commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Revenue. And together with Mr. Cummings, we will be presenting the Governor and Lieutenant Governor's tax bill.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Mr. Chairman, I do want to thank you for offering this bill. We appreciate your willingness to do that and for the time to hear the bill today. The Governor's tax bill is, of course, part of the larger budget picture. And in Minnesota, as you all know, we've had a varied history across the last 10 years in particular. We are now facing surpluses rather than deficits. And one of the governor's commitments is to ensuring that we have a stable of state budget going forward. And so his budget proposes expenditures and investments in education and human services, and also proposes this tax bill, which results in about $185 million in a tax reduction in the first biennium and about $367 million in a tax reduction in the second biennium. And Mr. Chairman, we'll go through each of the provisions that are in the order that are as they are drafted in the bill itself. But there are three main categories that we're going to talk about today, and so I just wanted to give a quick overview of what we're going to be talking about. First, there's tax relief for Minnesota's families and farmers. This includes a number of provisions that will reduce taxes for families across Minnesota, including farmers, cutting taxes for Minnesota families to the working family credit and child dependent care credit, and then to reduce some of the impacts that local farmers are seeing, particularly at this time of low commodity prices across Minnesota. The next segment of the bill focuses on partnering with local governments who deliver essential services across the state of Minnesota, from fire and rescue to other law enforcement, by providing additional aids, local government aid, county program aid, some additional reimbursement for some of the costs that counties carry under the Indian Child Welfare Act, and then the riparian aid protection deals with the buffer program that was adopted into law in 2015. And the third main category of provisions focuses on leveling the playing field for Minnesota's businesses. So there's provisions around corporate tax reform, tobacco tax product changes, modernizing the railroad property tax, and gross proceeds on non-ferrous mining.
Okay, with that, I'll officially call the House Tax Committee to order. I will move House File 893, but before we get into it any further, I visited with the sugar beet growers, kind of in your old stomping grounds, Mr. Cummings, kind of over there, and I was given a happy beet. This is a happy beet. So as we discuss this bill, if some folks think they might want to be a little cranky or something like that, just look at the happy beet. Okay? That is the happy beat that will be with us today. Okay, so that being said, I move House File 893. I move the 80893A1 amendment. Could someone from research tell us what we're doing here? A1.
Chair Davis. Chair Davis.
That's okay.
Representative Hertzog.
Thank you. You just need a green hat. You'd be a happy bee.
Got a big smile. Mr. Michael.
Mr. Chairman, this is a request of the governor, but it basically, the first provision corrects a reference in their changes for the captive insurance provisions to accurately reflect the right cross-references to paragraphs, and the other provision delays by 6 months the sales tax imposition on, digital.
Mr. Chair, the bill imposes the sales tax on consulting services related to pre-written computer software, and this delays the effective date of when those would become taxable by 6 months.
Yeah, I caught these things last night. So, Mr. Cummings, this is a department amendment.
Mr. Chair and members, so the amendment that you're referencing right now, in addition to the next amendment, this is just to conform the bill with the budget pages, as well as, ensuring the bill meets the intent, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Any discussion from members on the A1 amendment? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, members. I will now move the A17-0075 amendment. I think we're looking at the same thing, Mr. Cummings.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Any questions? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, members. Okay, now we have the bill in the shape the author prefers. So please continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. We would like to go through the provisions again. These provisions are in the order in which they are in the bill and on your summaries. The first provision is the Child Independent Care Credit. As you know, this is an existing credit. Many families in Minnesota are already eligible for this credit, but it does phase out at a relatively low income level. And so the governor and lieutenant governor are proposing expanding this credit so that 95,000 total Minnesota families could help pay for this expense. Minnesota is facing some of the highest child care costs in the nation, and we know that it's important for families to know that their children are well cared for when they go to work or school, and that this would raise the income eligibility to $89,000 for singles and over $100,000 for married filing jointly. We would like to thank a number of members who have helped work on this issue, in particular Representative Loon, for the bill that she proposed, the authoring this expansion. The governor has previously included a provision. This is a slightly different one and is modeled along the same lines that Representative Loon's provision is, and we recognize how important this is. And the next chart shows you what this expansion will do for Minnesota families. So it greatly expands the eligibility for this family. So an additional 62,000 families in Minnesota would be eligible.
Thank you, Representative Loon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Commissioner Bowerly. Thank you. It is an important provision. Obviously, I carried legislation very similar to that, which was in a version of that in the tax bill that was presented to the governor and then subsequently vetoed. So I'm wondering, it's disappointing that it came to that, because I think you said, was it 62,000 families, additional families would benefit from this credit if enacted?
Commissioner Bowerly.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Loon, yes, that's correct, 62,000.
Chair Loon.
And so do we know, thank you, Mr. Chair, the families that are currently struggling with daycare costs, and we know that Minnesota is one of the most expensive states in the nation for the cost of daycare, and that we have one of the highest number of dual-income working families or families working with very young children. Do we know sort of what the economic impact, has been on those families by not having this credit enacted for the current fiscal year.
Commissioner Bowerly.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Boone, we wouldn't have that as an aggregate, but we could looking at the estimate, which provides an average, we could probably come up with a rough ballpark of that.
Chair Loon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Commissioner Bowerly. Well, I would appreciate that because, again, I think, it was extremely disappointing for this member to have a bill that passed so overwhelmingly and bipartisanly through the legislature and sort of got hung up on maybe a couple of words, that, typos or whatnot that could have been corrected. Because as we're looking at avenues for trying to help families with the cost of child care, of the cost of quality early childhood education experiences for the family, something I've been working on for a long time, and the Education Committee will continue to review. This is something that could have provided tens of thousands of Minnesota families with some relief and some help with those costs, but unfortunately fell victim to a veto, which is, again, extremely unfortunate and detrimental to those families. So I hope we can get this rectified and in a tax bill that we can get passed very quickly this year. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Chair Loon. Lead Marquardt.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Chair. And I need to respond. I mean, folks back home, first of all, are sick and tired of the blame game. We didn't get a tax bill. We didn't get a bonding bill. We haven't got a transportation bill the last 2 years. And there's plenty of blame to go around why we didn't get either one of those three things done. But I will tell you, the folks back home don't care about that. They now want us this year to get a tax bill, a transportation bill, and a bonding bill. And, you know, now you talk about a word or two. I think it was about $100 million those words or two were worth. And we can argue whether or not we could have done something. But I don't think $100 million is chump change around here. And so, and I think all of us are very concerned about dollars here and there. And $100 million was pretty significant. And so I think those were some of the problems we had in the bonding bill, too. I mean, just things get rushed. But let's move on. Let's stop the blame game. A lot of people were inconvenienced because we didn't get these things done. Our farmers waiting for property tax relief also. And blame was to go Democrats and Republicans. So I get a little upset when I still hear the blame game when all I heard last summer and fall from folks was, well, you know, I heard from them, just get things done. We don't care. Just get it done. So thank you, and I like that little.
No, thank you, Mark. And, you know, we can't really look back, but I do have to say there was not a $100 million error in that bill. Joel Michael had, I can share it with you, the letter that I sent to the governor with four or five remedies very easily, whether it be a chairman's letter, whatever. That was so bogus, it's just unbelievable. I don't want to look back either. I think you're absolutely right. We have to put together, it's our job to put the second best tax bill ever written in history together. That's our job. But the $100 million, I really don't want to go there because, you know, that easily could have been corrected, number one. Number two, we could have been called back to special session if it was so urgent to, you know, correct it that way. We could have done it too. So, but I don't want to go backwards. I agree with you. But I think Chair Loon's comments are right on. Do we have more questions on this? Okay, Chair Detmer and then Loeffler. Chair Detmer.
Mr. Chair, and Representative Marquardt and I, we see eye to eye on a lot of different things, but your comment about people really don't care, you have to look at what went on this last election. People do care, and they do, when they do vote, they do care. And I just wanted to just say when I go out and talk to people, they say work together, get things done. I agree with you. And if we don't, they do care and they do respond.
Mr. Chair, my name
is
yours. Well, thank you very much, Mr. Chair, Representative Devin. Don't misunderstand me. I don't mean people don't care. They don't care why we did not get it done. What they care about is us getting it done. So it's not that folks don't care. They very much care about the things we didn't get done, but they're beyond why it did not get done. That was my point. So,
Chair Detman.
Well done.
Representative Loeffler. Oh, excuse me. Before we go to Representative Loeffler, you will have the floor. Representative Schultz moves the minutes of February 21, 2017. Any additions or corrections? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, members. Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And looking forward, I just wanted to again echo Representative Loon's comments to the administration in support of this Child Independent Care Credit, because I think it really does make a big difference for families that are working. And some of them are waiting for this, for the kind of economic relief they're looking for. Another group of them is the thousands of families on the basic sliding fee child care waiting list who are even lower income than this group, hoping to get up to this level. They're working, but they're not able to afford decent child care for their families because the waiting list in Hennepin County is over 2 years long. And that's a long time for a little kid to wait to get into a really actively programmed program. So I'm hoping that this is an area where we'll have some bipartisan interest in a lot of the committees and step forward so our families get our kids off to a good start. And thank you for continuing this and for the bipartisan work of Representative Loon and others on this.
Any other questions? Okay, Commissioner Barrow, please proceed. And members, we are on page 5.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And if I could just for a moment, the issue of the last year's tax bill. I have the utmost respect for the research staff here, and particularly Mr. Michael, and of course you, Mr. Chair. When the department looked at that provision, we concluded that that was the only appropriate way that we could administer that bill under those circumstances. We did a lot of analysis, I assure you, to look at other chair's letters and other circumstances, and we simply could find no authority for the department to take a provision that was unambiguous and find some ambiguity there. And, of course, we did, many of us did work all interim to try to work on special sessions that tried to get to all of those bills that were not completed last year, and we were unable to do so. So we do look forward to working with the committee going forward. You know, we could, if you would like to have a longer conversation about the department's analysis of last year's tax bill, we can certainly do that, Mr. Chairman, or we can, you know, we can do that now, we can do that at a later date, we can, you know, as the committee prefers. But
Mr. As my school teachers used to tell me when I was being a bit obstinate, they would say, Gregory, today is not the day. So.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I've been called many things. Obstinate is certainly one of them.
I was not. He was. Somebody wanted a headline over there. I think we might just have it here. No. That was me. I will only refer to myself, and I know that's hard to believe for everyone in this room, but it would happen from time to time. Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The next provision in the tax bill is the Working Family Credit. This is an expansion of the existing credit. It will help many more Minnesotans who are struggling to get into the middle class. These are working families who have been dealing with stagnant incomes and increased cost of living, and under the proposal, 372,000 tax returns of Minnesota families will be affected in 2017. The number of returns eligible for the credit would increase by 107,000. Again, as this chart will show you, this is an example of a family, a married filers with two children, would show you the areas of expansion. So it increases both at that income level and allows families to get to a larger credit at that lower income level. It also importantly includes single filers ages 21 to 24, allowing them access to the credit. This is similar to a proposal that is being discussed at the federal level as well that will allow these filers to have access to that credit. They're sometimes referred to as single filers, but they may well have children in their lives, and we know that providing economic stability for children through child support and other interactions with non-custodial parents is incredibly important. The governor and lieutenant governor have have proposed this bill. This is a broader expansion than the one they have proposed in the past. It also will help families across Minnesota. The Minnesota Budget Project has done a lot of good research about where this credit is received across Minnesota, and it really is serves greater Minnesota as well as the metro area. Mr. Chairman, I'd like to move on to a couple of smaller provisions, but important also to making sure that we are serving Minnesotans across the state. The first is increasing the military service credit. As you're aware, in the supplemental budget bill last year, the exclusion for military pension income was included. This addresses a different set of folks who have past military service, and this is a credit that they receive. This increases the threshold, the income cap from $40,000 to $60,000, and increases the amount of the credit they're eligible for to help to honor the service that those Minnesotans have given to our country. A couple of small corrections. The home office deduction, this is about the property tax, and there are two methods of calculating the property tax, and when you have a home office, the goal is to ensure that the amount of your residence is being claimed for the property tax refund, not the amount that you might have for your home office. So we're just making sure that everyone who is claiming the property tax refund is claiming it for that the part of their home that they're using for a residence. The estate tax recapture provision, this deals with the estate tax recapture provision that was put in place a couple of years ago, and the department has observed over time that there are instances, although few but important to those families, where through eminent domain they no longer are able to keep those acres until the land, and so this correction would make it clear that they are not subject to that recapture tax.
Excuse me, Commissioner Chair Detmer.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair and Commissioner. It's good to see that the military service credit is there and it's increased. This was in the bill last session on House File 848. And but I'm looking at I've got last year's language. There's also another veterans provision that I don't know if it's in the governor's bill this time, was the property tax exclusion for surviving spouses. We had that in the bill last year, too, where the current law is that the surviving spouse gets 8 more years of that exclusion on their property taxes. And what the language would have done, as it is in 848, in last year's tax bill, was that as long as the spouse stays in that home and owns a home and not remarries, that would be extended indefinitely. Is the governor going to be reinstating that in this year's tax bill?
Commissioner Bauerlein?
Mr. Chair and Representative Detmer, it is not in the bill, but I that is an area that we'd be happy to continue conversations with you about.
Yeah, Mr. Chair. This is that was one of the provisions that the Commander's Task Force, the 10 different veterans organizations that fall under the Commissioner of the Department of Affairs, this is one of their big priorities, is to keep that in the bill.
Okay. Thank you, Chair Detmer. Questions? Okay, please proceed, Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We will now move on to some property tax provisions, and we were pleased to be able to present these this morning in property tax provision, but for the benefit of the entire committee, we'll also cover them briefly here in this session. In 2015, as you know, there was a bumper law passed, and this proposal would allow for approximately 53,000 landowners across the state in agricultural and other property that would be going into buffers to receive a payment. The payment would be an annual payment of about $40 per acre for each tillable acre converted to buffer, and the payments would be made for 5 years. The goal of this program would be to help those folks with that kind of land that's going into the buffers to have some transition as they are making those changes to their land. You might be also aware of a new program in Minnesota, additional funding for the CREP program that's coming from the USDA. Those eligibility requirements are slightly different than this, but if land qualified for both, they would be able to take both of those types of payments. And we can $40 per acre is the average of the property tax attributable to that kind of property per acre.
Chair Erickson. Excuse me, Commissioner Ed. I usually just let you go, but I think we're going to have some questions here. Chair Erickson.
Well, Mr. Chair, and the Commissioner already knows my concerns about the buffer. It is good that we are going to provide some funding for farmers, but Mr. Chair and Committee, this is the taking of land. And so the whole policy behind this buffer is really bothering me and certainly bothering the farmers in this state. I, during the fall, was having conversations with Representative Paul Anderson, with other legislators in other parts of the state, because in East Central we were really feeling a lot of pressure about what to do with creeks that haven't had water in them for 50 years and yet required to have a buffer and the taking of sometimes hundreds of acres if a creek was running through farmers' land and there had been no water running through it in all that time. So this, and the Commissioner knows my feeling on this. You know, this was in the tax bill last year to begin some relief. Nevertheless, I think the fact that we have this buffer law needs to be revisited. And my colleagues may not even agree with me, but I am very concerned about this policy, this requirement. But, Mr. Chair, I need to ask the Commissioner to check something that I didn't get to speak to in property taxes this morning. Commissioner, in House File 1226, please note this, Mr. Cummings, on page 72, under in section 24, under tax forfeited land, we are now adding school forest to that. And I need to have an explanation as to why school forest is being added to section 24 in 1226.
Chair Erickson, are going to be hearing that bill at a later date,
okay.
I do believe, if
okay.
we could.
Well,
but
maybe.
But if you, Mr. Cummings,
he doesn't have to address it now. I just had the chance to speak, Mr. Speaker, or Mr. Chair, and I wanted to assure they knew I have a concern about it.
Mr. Cummings.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair and members, on the school forest portion, we did talk to Mr. Rubis and Mr. Michael and Representative Loon 2 years ago to try and see if what the impact of this provision would be or to talk about it. And I know that there was a discussion whether this should be heard in the education committees. The conclusion is that it wouldn't, but we look forward to working with Representative Erickson to further talk about this provision and to try and ameliorate any of the concerns that she may have.
Okay, you still have the floor, Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, it's a deed tax of $165 for a conveyance of tax forfeited lands for a governmental subdivision for an authorized public use, and one of those then would include school forest. And we just need to have clarification on this, Mr. Chair, because a deed tax on school forest land, I need to know more. Thank you.
No, thank you, Chair Erickson, and I think it's duly noted with the department on that. One quick question I have is, and I don't mean to go back to 848, but that's what's in my head. On 848, we did $10 million to the counties. Now, with what's being proposed here, how are we funding that? Does the government do anything like with the $10 million that we did last year, or because we kind of like gave the counties a lot of discretion on how to do that, or how is this going to be funded, proposed to be funded, Commissioner?
Mr. Chairman, thank you. The governor has two provisions in the bill that deal with buffers. This is a program to provide these payments directly to the farmers. There is an additional $10 million in the bill that is under the riparian aid program that we will get to in a few minutes that goes to the counties and local soil and water districts for the implementation that they are going to be engaging in.
And I guess we're not too far off the field here, but Chair Erickson's comment, I just spoke to the sugar beet growers, and they were not happy bees when it comes to the whole buffer issue. So I had to hand a few of those out to a few of those guys who were getting just a bit cranky. Okay. With that being said, please, Commissioner Quirtos.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Commissioner Bowerly, Mr. Cummins, on the buffer compensation program, in the previous hour, you mentioned that not everybody would be eligible for this benefit. Could you expand on that again, please?
Mr. Chair and Representative Quirtos, this is limited to people who are going to be making the changes in order to become compliant with the program. We know that there are you know, thousands and thousands of acres across the state that already are in compliance with this. So this short-term five-year program that is intended to be a short-term program for these farmers, these are the people that are required to make the transition. Not the program as designed right now is would not be for people who have already made the transition. So that so we just want to be clear about that. So so that, you know, people who have the type of stewardship practices that would be in compliance with the buffer law would not be eligible for the $40 payment over 5 years.
Representative Burkoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I thought about that since you mentioned it, and you know, the fact that someone else has, as you deemed it, are compliant now, I'd like to point out that that's a management decision with regard to how you farm those acres. Mm-hmm. That's a discretionary management decision. And so that individual who may be in compliance according to a new law is being denied the management decision to use those acres in the highest and best use as they deem necessary given their circumstance. And sometimes farmers idle or rest land. It may be because maybe water was high or groundwater was high, and so they chose not to plant that area. But you are, in effect, taking away a management decision with how you're applying aid in this circumstance. So I disagree with the policy that only people who, you know, are managing their property differently today should get a benefit from complying with this new law, as opposed to those who have exercised a management decision that you're taking that discretion away.
Mr. Cummings?
And Mr. Chair, we look forward to working with Representative Hurtas and others who might be interested in this. The genesis of this was the governor went out and listened to the voices of farmers and the types of impact that it would have on them. And that is why he really tried to look for a way to do that. The reason why it's limited in that way is because we're trying to figure out the way to best use the dollars that we have. So we could have a program that would apply to many more farmers. It would cost more money. And so we're just trying to think about how do we design a program to compensate farmers. So that's what we're trying to do. But we'd look forward to working with you and to try and figure out what is the best way to apply to aid for these types of people in these situations.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that centers around my question.
Chair Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And something that we brought up in property tax was, why is a legacy used for this? If this is going to be ongoing, and this is part of our natural resource, and I think a purpose for legacy, I hope that the administration will consider ongoing use of legacy dollars for this, if indeed we're going to have this payment, and then spread it to all who have to put up with a buffer now on their what has been very good tillable land.
Okay. Comments from the department?
Mr. Chair, Representative Erickson, as we indicated previously, the governor has proposed general fund, but we are happy to continue the conversation about this program.
Because that would not be supplanting anything, because this is a new...
That's right.
Okay. Chair Knobloch.
Mr. Cummings, or Commissioner, what does the department estimate the average value of an acre of this land to be?
Mr. Cummings?
Mr. Chair, I don't have that right offhand. I can in just a few minutes. Mr. Chair.
Chair Knobloch.
Okay. What's the average value of an acre of farmland in the state? Do you have any idea?
Mr. Cummings?
I don't have that right offhand, but I can get it to you very quickly, Mr. Chair.
Okay. All right. I'll wait for
Chair
that.
Chair Knobloch. Okay. We'll come back to you, Chair Knobloch. Chair Daskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Commissioner and Mr. Cummings. We did have a discussion around this in property tax earlier today, and I'm heartened to hear that the administration might be interested in considering legacy. And just to remind members, the Constitution says to restore, enhance, and protect. And if indeed this governor's initiative, which was to do this buffer program, which, as many of us know, is a constitutional taking. And our Constitution says very clearly that if you're going to take land from people, you have to compensate them properly for it. And we still have not done that. So in my mind, either we need to repeal the existing statute, I believe it was a mistake, or we need to pay them for it. And members, you know, if we go forward with policy that takes general fund money to ostensibly pay farmers for a portion of that taking, which is what this appears to be, we have to remember that the Constitution also says under the legacy amendment that once we commit that money, we will not be able to uncommit that general fund money again in fear of being in constitutional violation at that point of supplanting. So this is an important point in time in this discussion. If indeed we are going to make the people whole in terms of the Constitution, Mr. Chair, if we extend general fund money now, we aren't going to be able to unextend that money in the future, because the Constitution says at that point, when you want to use legacy money, guess what? You got $10 million in there. You got to keep it in there if you're going to put more, if you're going to put legacy money in there. Otherwise, you're in a constitutional violation. So I think it's very important we have this discussion, Commissioner, and I would encourage this more development of this discussion as we go forward.
The Chair to ask Counselor, well, you could unextend it, but then you couldn't use legacy money. You could get rid of it, but then you couldn't.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You could never use legacy money, as some would at least interpret the Constitution.
Okay. You would like to proceed, or other questions, or okay? Please proceed, Commissioner Bowerly.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The next provision deals with debt service equalization, which is an existing formula in Minnesota, but has not been funded at previous levels. This formula goes out to school districts, particularly those with low tax bases, to help them finance school buildings. This is a pair with the next proposal, which is about the school agricultural bond credit. Minnesota students need a world-class education wherever they live in Minnesota, and for those districts where there are lower tax bases, they have a higher, the burden of paying for modern schools can fall disproportionately on just a few businesses, farms, or homeowners. The governor is proposing adding $62 million over 4 years to help these districts. Debt service equalization has been around since 1993 and was restructured again in 2003. The governor recommends increasing the state share of school debt service revenue from 3% in 17 to up to 5.6% in 2021. And debt service equalization helps ensure that school districts, regardless of property wealth, can provide adequate education facilities for their students by helping offset those property owners' relatively high tax burdens in areas with low to moderate tax bases. So this additional aid will fund school facilities in locations around the state of Minnesota. Mr. Chairman and members, there is one more small provision that is next in the bill that deals with agricultural homestead credit modifications. This is how we calculate the credit for fractional agricultural homesteads based on the market value of homestead land. The proposal would clarify that the percentage of homestead would be split evenly among the homeowners of the property. This is a conversation that we had with all of you at the end of last year about how to address these fractional homesteads, and this is our recommendation on how we would go about this. So under current law, for agricultural homestead chains with homestead and non-homestead value, the agricultural market value credit is to be calculated on the total market value of all homestead and non-homestead land and then prorated to each owner based on the each owner occupant's percentage of ownership. And there has been some confusion across the state and some differences in how counties are administering this. And so this proposal makes some choices about how to do that and provides a reasonable response to those various applications across the state. So we'll provide uniform application of these homestead credits and uniform treatment of these property owners.
Excuse me, Chair Groffel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And neither for nonpartisan staff or for the testifiers, on page 17, section 2, paragraph C, this is the modification to the second tier debt service equalization. If we could get, I don't know if we work with Mr. Strom on the education side, but if we could get, number one, the fiscal cost of that, And number two, what school districts would be impacted by it? If, perhaps that could be shared with the committee. That would be appreciative.
Mr. Michael?
Unless Mr. Michael has this memorized and can list this off the top.
Probably
not. He probably can, yeah.
Mr. Michael? Mr. Chairman, we'll pass that request along to Mr. Strong.
Thank you very much. Chair Groffel? That's good. Thank you.
Okay. Commissioner Marley.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. The next provision is the School Building Bond Agricultural Credit. This committee has seen this provision before. It was in 848. We want to thank Mr. Joskowski and Representative Marquardt for their work on this proposal. The governor also recognizes the importance of this proposal, particularly at a time when commodity prices are very low and farm land values are still relatively high. The research that we see across the state is that they are starting to tick down, but they will take some time to come down. And the governor has, recognizing that, is included in his tax bill this year. This, of course, will reduce property taxes for farmers by, with a credit equal to 40% of their tax bill attributable to those school bond buildings. And I was able to travel to both Worthington and near Moorhead in the last couple of weeks, and it is really clear that there are a number of communities across the state of Minnesota where this divide is becoming a very contentious issue in those communities. And students, wherever they live in Minnesota, deserve to have a good education and need good educational facilities. And so this credit will help make sure that those going forward, that those school bonds will help be paid for by those farmers. And also it does apply to existing school bonds. So going forward, the share that is still left on those bonds that are showing up on farm property tax bills will also be subject to that 40% credit.
Chair Graskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Commissioner Bowerly. And members, I Representative Hertaus let me know earlier for the record I said constitutional, I guess unconstitutional taking. My passions overwhelmed me. So I appreciate the discussion about this particular item, and I'm curious, Commissioner, is this exactly the same language that we had in House File 848?
Yeah.
Commissioner Bowerly?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Joskowski, this is the same provision at 40%.
Chair Joskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I'm glad to see it there. I'm just still kind of share some of the same concerns we talked about earlier. Representative Marquardt, I know the discussion about people, you know, don't want to hear the why about what happened. But I have heard a lot from farm communities about this after the veto, and they were very frustrated. And farmers don't want to see the same thing repeated, neither do our rural schools. We've had two bond referendums fail in my district since the veto happened. And if we don't avoid the future, avoid doing in the future what happened in the past, we are remiss. And so I still don't know why the governor vetoed the bill, Commissioner. Especially when apparently he was in favor of this very important provision for rural Minnesota, but, you know, apparently maybe the governor's seen the light. And so I think that's encouraging for Minnesota farmers and Minnesota rural schools. But I think we need to certainly at least agree that we're not going to have the same almost hijacking of this provision and the tax bill happen over some train again or some other want or desire, and we hope that the administration will keep their eyes fixed on the prize, and the prize is to do what's in the interest of Minnesotans. In this case, is to provide property tax relief for Minnesota's farmers and create a situation where we get rid of the divide between town and rural areas within our school districts in rural Minnesota. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Chair Graskowski. And I, too, you know, I'm a really good poker player, but I really like this provision. This is good. This is a good thing. And just remember, too much of a good thing is a good thing. This provision, and Lee Marquardt, you've been active in this, Hertaus, Graskowski, and others. This committee, I'll speak for this committee. We like this provision. And I want to thank the governor for proposing this. And as I've said many times, you know, normally when a governor, whether it be Republican or Democrat, comes in with a tax bill,
I usually just make the comment, well, at least we recycle the paper it's printed on. I didn't say that this time because I read through these provisions, and, of course, this is kind of top of my list, so I've just given up my bargaining power on this because it's, because it's very good. So please continue, Commissioner Bauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The next provision deals with another property tax provision that exists in current Minnesota law. It's called the Senior Citizen Property Tax Deferral Program. And under this program, seniors, it helps seniors stay in their homes by allowing them to apply to the state for this program, which helps pay their property taxes for them. But one of the things that we have observed in administering this program is that sometimes seniors may not realize until they get their October bill that they may have trouble paying for it. And by then, the statutory deadline for this program has already passed. And so this proposal recommends moving that to November 1st so that we can allow more seniors to take advantage of this program. In addition, it would reduce the number of years required for owner occupancy requirements. The patterns in which people, how long people stay in their homes have changed. Sometimes empty nesters move to a different house, and so this would make those the occupancy requirements more akin to sort of modern practices that we see across Minnesota. And so expanding this program, changing the ownership occupancy to from 5 to 15 years and changing the deadline will allow more seniors who are facing these circumstances to stabilize their financial situation and hopefully stay in their homes.
Commissioner, don't you mean 15 to 5?
Yes, sorry. Reducing it from 15 to 5 years.
Yeah, you said 5 to 15.
My apologies.
No, fine. I just want to make sure we have that right.
Yes.
Chair Carlson.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, you may remember I had some legislation last session where we tried to ease the burden of payment, and I had a couple of different proposals that I had worked with on staff. But is there a way, Commissioner, where those that qualify for the property tax refund that are especially senior citizens, but other citizens as well, could subtract that somehow before they make the payment so they don't have as large a payment in May and October?
Commissioner Bauerle.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Carlson, as the property tax refund is currently constructed, it's administered by the department directly as a refund program. I think in order to connect it more closely to the payments that are paid to your county when you make those, it would have to be administered by counties. And I think we'd have to talk with them about whether and how challenging that might be for them and the kind of processing that would take. We process 800,000 property tax refunds every year from Minnesotans, so it's quite a significant volume. But I do hear your point, which is, waiting, sometimes refunds, whether it's income tax refunds or credits or the property tax refund, is not always the most efficient way. There's a time lag there. So we'd be happy to think about solutions that might, that could be possible. But I think that would be at least one of the issues we have to deal with, and it would be significant.
Yeah, and Mr. Chairman, I'd appreciate it if the department would look at different scenarios. That was not an idea that I dreamed up. It came from senior citizens, primarily from not necessarily my legislative district, some were from basically the northwest suburbs that I would describe as activists on senior issues. And that was something that they put out there that they thought would help with especially, and actually when they went beyond, some of them senior citizens, but low-income people as well that have difficulty perhaps making the upfront payment, knowing that eventually they're going to get a refund. And if there was some way we could calculate that in so they don't have to make as large an upfront payment, I think was basically what their request was. They were lay people, so they didn't have probably the best way of maybe administering that, but maybe some of the staff that I worked with here remember that that issue. And we did have a couple of scenarios that we floated, but if you could give that some consideration internally, I'd appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Commissioner Bauer, please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm now going to turn it over to Mr. Cummings to talk about the next section.
Mr. Cummings.
For the record, Mr. Chair and members, my name is Paul Cummings, and I'm the Tax Policy Manager at the Minnesota Department of Revenue.
Welcome to the committee.
We appreciate the partnership that we have with local units of government. The following recommendations are aimed at providing targeted aid to ensure the best possible outcomes for Minnesotans and to reduce the pressure on property taxes. Article 2, Section 3 deals with the Indian Child Welfare Act and provides aid. A version of this was included in House File 848, Mr. Chair. Prior to 1978, Indian children were placed in foster care at a nationwide rate 10 to 20 times that for non-Indian children. These children are often lost connections with their families, extended families, tribes, and cultural heritage. The goal of the Indian Child Welfare Act is to ensure that Indian children remain with their parents whenever possible. Providing these services is costly, and those expenses are primarily borne on the counties. The governor recommends an aid payment of $10 million annually that would be proportionately based on the non-federal share of costs incurred by a county social service agency or correctional agency.
Mr. Cummings, you go to the next slide so people in the audience can see what you're talking about.
We apologize. Operator.
From 15 to 5.
Mr. Chair, I'll move on from to talk about LGA and CPA.
Thank you.
This is Article 2, Section 14 and 15. The governor and lieutenant governor recommend increasing local government aid by $20 million per year and county program aid by $10 million per year. This proposal would be effective for aids payable in calendar year 2018. Local government aid and county program aid are important tools in the state and local partnership. They help local governments pay for vital needs such as local roads and public safety, and also help keep property taxes low. LGA funding is currently below the level of aid paid out in 2002 before adjusting for inflation. After 2002, LGA was routinely cut for years, during which time local government increased their property taxes. CBA funding is also below actual aid paid out in 2002 before adjusting for inflation. We wanted to move on to the riparian protection aid. This was included in House File 848 as well, and is Article 2, Section 16 of this year's bill. During the 2015 legislative session, laws were enacted requiring riparian buffer land on public waters and drainage systems. Landowners with land on public waters are required to have buffers in place by November 1st of this year, the deadline of November 1st of 18 on public drainage systems. The following factors are used to distribute the aid: the number of acres classified as 2A, the number of centerline miles of public water courses, and the number of miles of public drainage. The maximum age to a county is $200,000, and the minimum is $45,000. This is split between watershed districts and counties. These aid programs, in partnership with local units of government, help to lower the pressure on regressive property taxes. Representative Knobloch asked a question about the land values. The statewide average of land for 2A land is $4,400 per acre. The average value used for the buffer provision is $4,800 per acre for 2A. Weighted by where the buffers actually are, it's about $2,100 for 2B, Mr. Chair.
Chair Knobloch. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So you're saying that the average buffer land for what you would be looking at compensate people $200 over 5 years, the average value of the land would be about $2,100?
That's for 2B, Mr. Chair. For 2A, it is $4,800.
Okay, so basically the governor's proposal would pay people $200 for land that was worth, on average, $2,100 to $4,800.
So, Mr. Chair, the provisions in this proposal deal with compensation for property taxes, and we found that the average property tax on those types of land was $40.
Chair, now,
so it is covering the property taxes for this land, which is the intent of this proposal.
Okay, Mr. Chair, as long as I've got the floor, can I ask, is the governor on a different subject regarding the county program aid, is the governor recommending a change in the county program aid formula?
Mr. Cummings?
Mr. Chair, the governor is recommending $10 million additional aid to the current formula. We do look forward to working with counties and others if they have recommendations to improving the formula. In our policy bill, we also have recommendations on how county program aid can be improved.
Chair Knobloch? In fact, I think I have a bill to do some changes to that. I got a lot of bills. I think I got one for that.
Mr. Chair, and Representative Knobloch, to be clear, our improvement in our policy bill deals with the county program aid data lag so that legislators have better information during session. And, but we're open to continuing to talk about changes to the formula as well as other changes to CPA. This proposal just adds $10 million on the existing formula.
Okay, I appreciate that, because I know that the county program aid formula is very controversial with definitely winners and losers in it. So, thank you.
Representative Hertaus.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Cummins, Commissioner Bowerly, I have a question about the Indian Child Welfare Act aid. Having spent 4 years on K-12, there's about 850 to 900,000 students in the state. And would it be reasonable for me to then suggest that Indian population in our state is 1.5% or something like that, that it would maybe equal, you know, 8,500 kids, Indian kids? Would that be a reasonably fair assumption?
So, Mr. Chair,
Mr. Cummings,
I do see Representative Erickson nodding her head, but I could get you that number in terms of how many Indian children are in the state. I don't have that number in front of me, Representative Hertaus.
Representative Hertaus?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I guess I was just trying to work the numbers backwards in terms of trying to figure out how much aid per child is. I would assume that not every child would necessarily be eligible for aid. This is probably targeted at the youngest of them. So I was just trying to figure out at $10 million what level of support that is, kind of on a per-student basis that would be eligible. And it looks like it would be several thousand dollars if I'm doing the math correctly. And, you know, we struggle to raise the general levy for education by $10 or $15 or $20 sometimes, it seems. So I don't know if you've got a cost associated with, you know, per Indian child that would benefit.
Mr. Cummings.
So, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee, Representative Hertaus, we'll provide some scenarios at what sort of these costs are and what are the mandates. These costs are borne by counties, and they are the costs of out-of-home placement. And so these are required under the Indian Child Welfare Act. But to your question, we will provide some scenarios in terms of what is the cost borne on counties. Because whether or not it's reimbursed by the state, by what the governor's recommending, or whether counties are having to do it themselves, these costs are borne. I mean, it's a requirement under the law. So it's just, you know, how do we pay for it?
Representative Hertaus?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for that clarification.
Please continue, Commissioner. Or Mr. Cummings.
Mr. Chair, Governor Dayton and Lieutenant Governor Smith make strategic and targeted recommendations to assist locals in economic development. Article 2, Section 17 deals with the property tax exemption for the soccer stadium. Governor Dayton and Lieutenant Governor Smith recommend providing an exemption from property tax for the proposed soccer stadium in St. Paul. Providing a property tax exemption would make the stadium consistent with other major league stadiums in Minnesota. This exemption would be from state and local property taxes and would apply to any properties with the primary purpose of providing a stadium for professional soccer. This site is currently exempt from property tax in its current use. Article 2, Section 18 deals with the Medelia, and I talked about that earlier, Mr. Chair. Governor Dayton and Lieutenant Governor Smith recommend $31,000 in additional aid to the city of Medelia and $15,000 in additional aid to Watonwan County to mitigate the loss of property tax revenue due to the Medelia fire.
Representative Gruenhagen.
Oh, well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Cummings. Is there a provision in the tax bill I'd like to address on the railroad property tax provision? Are you going to get to that yet? Or
I think we're coming up to that.
Oh, okay.
We'll come to you at that point. Chair Loon.
Thank you, and sorry, but just since you mentioned the soccer stadium and Representative Gruenhagen's question wasn't on that, I wanted to ask. So the proposed soccer stadium in St. Paul, would that be a publicly owned stadium or privately owned?
Mr. Cummings?
Mr. Chair, I think I'm going to let the advocate speak to how that arrangement is being worked out with the soccer stadium.
And we do have Commissioner Bowerly.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Loon, it's our understanding that the city of St. Paul will ultimately own that, and I believe the city is here, so if there are further questions on that. But ultimately, the city will own the stadium.
Chair Loon.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'll be interested in hearing them from the advocates. But just again, and I raised this when we discussed this in the tax bill last year, concerns about, I mean, I know the property currently is owned by a government entity, and so it's not subject to property tax, but again, as we have talked about some other programs, fiscal disparities is one that is of interest to me and to a lot of cities in the Southwest metro area. And, you know, the opportunity to put a property on the property tax rolls to help with St. Paul's revenues and property taxes, I think is a good thing. And I just have concerns about keeping this off the property tax rolls as it's being developed. So I just wanted to put that on the record, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Chair Lone. Please proceed.
Mr. Chair and members, I will now go through, describe some of Governor Dayton and Lieutenant Governor Smith's proposals related to tax fairness. Article 3 contains provisions related to untaxed tobacco products, vapor, and moist snuff. The transfer of untaxed tobacco products into the state has substantially increased in the last few years. I want to be clear, Mr. Chair and members, we are not referring to cigarettes. We are referring to what we call other tobacco products, or OTP, including loose tobacco, moist snuff, and cigars. To put a stop to this illegal activity, this proposal would enhance enforcement by increasing penalties on lawbreakers to ensure that honest businesses are not at a competitive disadvantage. In the past year, concerns about the level of compliance with tax laws related to tobacco products have grown. In 2014, 40% of retail inspections resulted in either a seizure or assessment related to the discovery of untaxed tobacco products. In these inspections, the Department of Revenue uncovered increasing evidence of tax evasion. Enhancing tobacco enforcement was one of the recommendations in the 2014 study of Minnesota's tobacco tax collection system. So Governor Dayton and Lieutenant Governor Smith recommend enhancing penalties for noncompliance with the tobacco laws, including the suspension of retail license and civil penalties. In addition, establishing a process whereby the Department of Revenue can revoke a retailer's cigarette or tobacco license, expanding invoice retention requirements for cigarette and tobacco products, and establish civil penalties for violation of these requirements, increasing the license fee for cigarette and tobacco distributors and subjobbers, and providing the Department of Revenue authority to refuse or issue or renew a distributor or subjobber license. Several other states, such as Iowa, Illinois, and Ohio, have a tiered penalty system for retailers of tobacco products. This was another recommendation in the 2014 study of Minnesota's tobacco tax collection systems.
Vice Chair McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Cummings, I have some interested advocates that would like me to ask a question regarding the vapor tax. And is Minnesota compliant with the FDA guidelines? And if so, what are the FDA guidelines on vapor?
So, Mr. Cummings, that is the next section that I'll go over, Mr. Chair, if that's okay.
Okay, so that's bullet two?
Yep.
Okay.
In addition, the past 2 years, we've reached out to the industry and sought their partnership on the proposals that I just described. In response to their feedback, we've removed our proposal to impose a state-based retail license requirement. We look forward to working with the industry on these recommendations. Representative McDonald and Mr. Chair, to the vapor question, new regulations from the Food and Drug Administration could dramatically alter the way certain vapor products are manufactured. FDA finalized a rule that was effective last August to regulate all tobacco products. These rules deem all vapor products to be tobacco products. Governor Dayton and Lieutenant Governor Smith's proposal would standardize how vapor products are taxed in Minnesota. Many vapor products are currently taxed at the 95% OTP rate on only the highly concentrated nicotine itself, solution itself, rather than on the sale of the final consumable product. Many times these are called open systems. Meanwhile, vapor products that are in a consumable form when brought into the state, many times these are called closed systems, are taxed at the same 95% rate, but on a higher value. This proposal would end that inequity by exempting the highly concentrated nicotine solution and applying the 95% rate when it is a finished consumable product. This proposal would provide greater parity between open and closed systems. The taxing structure on this proposal would be consistent for all taxpayers and provide clear guidance for the industry as well as the Department of Revenue. I'm not sure if that was helpful in answering your questions, Representative McDonald.
Vice Chair McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Cummings. No, not really, but I was reading and listening at the same time, kind of multitasking. I'm not engaged too much in the conversation, although I know some experts in the field outside the table here that say that Minnesota is in compliance with the FDA, but according to the governor, we are not. Can you clarify that?
Mr. Cummings?
Mr. Chair, there are, and Representative McDonald, there are regulatory mandates that the FDA has brought on many of these people who manufacture these type of vapor products. So they would have to be in compliance with the FDA regulations. This is a proposal to standardize the taxation, not necessarily the regulation. So we many times we build the way in which we tax things on based on how they're regulated. So the FDA regulations are going to go into effect. This would be something that would go along with that. But it wouldn't be replacing them, or it wouldn't be saying that they would come out of compliance with those FDA regulations.
Vice Chair McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's enough for now.
Please proceed.
Mr. Chair.
Excuse me. Vice Chair McDonald.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Just in regards to Mr. Cummings, Section 2, regarding contraband cigarettes, and then any retailer that is selling that, there'll be, I see they want to have a names and lists for up to 5 years to probably, I suppose, intimidation and shame for their illegal activity. What's the cost on something like that in doing so, and the intent other than to stop any illegal contraband sale of
Mr. Cummings?
Mr. Chair, the intent is to ensure that we are not, that, you know, distributors are trying to do the job, right? They're trying to do the job and to ensure that people are complying with the law. But if they don't have any idea in terms of who are people that they could sell to, then it becomes a point in which they are maybe unknowingly selling tobacco products to people who really shouldn't be allowed to do that. So this is an effort to try and ensure that that we have a level playing field, that the businesses that are engaging in the business practices that are according to all the laws are not at a competitive disadvantage, and it is ensuring that we're selling to the products to the right people.
Vice Chair McDonald.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Chair, Mr. Cummings. So then just lastly, so their names will be on the list for 5 years, shame on them for selling illegal cigarettes or contraband, but will their license be revoked for that period of time or less?
Mr. Cummings.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, so we do go through, within part of this bill, there is a process that we could revoke a license, but we would have to go through quite a process to do that. Many times if we do see violations of the law that's going on, we would work with our local unit of government partners, as they are the people who directly have oversight. There is another mechanism in order to revoke that, but it would be very lengthy with many checks and balances. I think one of the part is to go to administrative law judge or other types of things. So, but many times we work with local units of government. Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Vice Chair McDonald.
Very good. Thank you.
Okay, please proceed, Mr. Cummings.
And on the tax stamps for moist snuff, the transfer of untaxed tobacco products in Minnesota continues to be a problem. Current law makes compliance efforts very difficult. The most effective solution is to require tax stamps on other tobacco products, similar to the stamps already required on cigarettes. Tax stamps would make it easy to tell if Minnesota tax has been paid on other tobacco products like moist snuff, and to determine whether they came from in order to compare the inventory to invoices at the retail location or the distributor location. It would also drive more business towards law-abiding distributors. While tax stamps on moist snuff may have been difficult in the past, new advances in technology and machinery make this something possible. We are starting with moist snuff because we believe it is in a more standardized package. Mr. Chair, Commissioner Bowerly will now describe Governor Dayton and Lieutenant Governor Smith's other tax fairness provisions.
Okay, Chair Erickson to Mr. Cummings, I believe.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Cummings, on page 45, under subdivision 2 of section 29, stamps that you were just talking about for moist snuff, why are we having a different design for those that are sold on an Indian reservation?
Mr. Cummings.
I am going to ask our attorney, Mr. Peterson, to come forward. Do you answer that question?
Why don't you just get another chair? Mr. Cummings, you can stay there. Let's just get another chair. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir.
Mr. Chair, my name is Mark Peterson. I'm an attorney with the Department of Revenue.
Did you hear Chair Erickson's question?
Yes, I did, sir.
Okay, to the question.
We have tax agreements with most of the tribes, and under those agreements, we end up sharing some of the revenues with the tribes. And since we've had those agreements in place, we've had separate stamps that are only allowed to be used on Indian reservations. And the reason we have those is to help make sure that those stamps and those cigarettes don't end up getting purchased off and sold off reservation. So this moist snuff stamp would have the same purpose, to make sure that we were able to identify those as not being sold off reservation, acquired from Indian sources.
Chair Erickson.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, sir, because that is accountability, and that is a good policy. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Erickson. Commissioner Bollerly.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll now cover some of the corporate tax reforms that are contained in the Lieutenant Governor's bill. These are a set of provisions that are really aimed at bringing fairness. Mr. Chairman, I know you are adverse to the use of the word loophole, so we will call them tax clarifications and bring consistency to some of our tax provisions, particularly as they relate across businesses.
Thank you, Commissioner. You probably just saved about a half-hour debate. And I noticed that, and I leaned over to Mr. Rubis and said, they are good. Yeah, very good.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We had a very interesting conversation about the dictionary in your office, which I appreciated, the academic discussion.
Yes, we did, and we settled on the David's Dictionary definition.
It's your committee, Mr. Chairman.
To heck with Webster. We didn't need Webster, so please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The first item in this set of proposals is looking at economic substance, and this would allow the department to look at transactions and organizational structures that are structured only to avoid tax and do not serve a business purpose. Some of you may know, this is a common law doctrine. It actually exists in 19 states, and the federal government also has this authority. And we thought that we had it here in Minnesota until a court case, and so we need to put this into statute. And this test, the test would be the same as with federal law. The proposal is a two-pronged test to determine whether a transaction has economic substance. The transaction has economic substance, and if it changes the taxpayer's economic position in a meaningful way, and it has a substantial purpose other than its tax effects. This proposal has been in the governor's bills before. We look forward to continuing the conversation about it and other provisions that fall into this space of looking at economic substance. The next provision is extending and modifying the angel investment tax credit. We know there's a lot of interest in this provision, and we look forward to working with members on this. The governor's proposal is to extend it for an additional year, add $10 million, and to make some modifications to the provisions, particularly with respect to targeted groups, to include veteran-owned businesses owned by people with disabilities and businesses owned by people of color, to expand the use of this program. The fiduciary automatic tax filing extension is a provision that would allow the department, or once this is in statute, would no longer require the imposition of a penalty when a federal extension for this return has been granted. Under current Minnesota law, when that federal extension is granted, it doesn't automatically extend the Minnesota filing date, and so penalties can accrue. And so this is a recommendation to make clear that once that federal extension has been granted, it would work for Minnesota too, because that return information starts with that federal return. The next provision deals with the definition of a financial institution. The proposal would expand the definition of financial institution beyond corporations and include all entities engaging in this activity, including partnerships and limited liability companies performing those same activities. The proposal would remove the advantage of transferring loans and interest income to an affiliated partnership or LLC that does not tax as a financial institution, and reflects a more consistent way to report and pay taxes for partnerships and LLCs. The next provision deals with gain on the sale of businesses. Accelerating the recognition of the gain on the sale from the pastor business, one that would be sold in installment sales reporting method and resulting in the owner no longer having a Minnesota reporting requirement. Well, we have seen, again, many of these deal with very few instances, but we are seeing a potential trend where if I were to had a business and were to sell it to someone and avoided the payments on that for a number of years until I established residency in another state, I could avoid the sale of that Minnesota business. So this would recognize that gain for that sale at the time of the actual sale as opposed to the payments. It would not prohibit installment payments in any way. It would just simply recognize the sale at the time that it actually occurred. Excuse me, Mr. Chairman, and members. The next provision deals with R&D credit, and we know there's also a lot of interest in the R&D credit, and we look forward to continuing those conversations with the committee. This provision deals with that original base year, and one of the things that we have observed in administering this credit is because base years are often quite some time ago, people don't have records. And so the department has been in a position of needing to deny that credit because they lack those original records of when that that initial investment was made. And so this provision would allow to use a 16% base year when a company no longer has records for that base year. It would allow a greater credit if the company does have records, but it would sort of provide that minimum, that initial base year under this new provision in law so that more companies could take advantage of this R&D credit.
Very good. Thank you, Commissioner. We have a question from Representative Hertaus.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Bowery, just a question on the installment transaction and the sale. Am I reading it correctly that to recognize the tax means the entire tax on the gain is due at the time of sale and not in an installment manner?
Well, Commissioner Bowery or someone from the department?
Representative Hertaus, what this would either mean is that the gain on the sale would be recognized at the time of the sale, or you could enter into an agreement with the Department of Revenue to pay the tax over time through installments when you know the income was realized. So those were the two options that would be available under the proposed.
Representative Hertaus.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So that decision is a discretionary on the part of the department? Is it a unilateral decision, or is it something that basically the taxpayer is going to be assured that they'd be able to enter into a sale transaction knowing that they can pay this tax in installments along with each installment that they receive from their business?
Mr. Cummings.
So, Mr. Chair and Representative Hertaus, the taxpayer would have the choice to either pay the tax up front on the sale when the sale happens, or they would have the choice to enter an agreement with the department.
Representative Hertaus.
Mr. Chair, thank you for that clarification.
Commissioner Bowerly, you may continue.
Thank you. The next provision deals with non-admitted insurance companies, and particularly the impact we were seeing with regard to the combined unitary business return. This proposal addresses a gap in which businesses have been using to shift income previously subject to the corporate tax to a qualifying insurance company member that is not subject to the tax. As you know, in Minnesota, insurance companies don't pay the corporate unitary tax. They pay premium taxes. But what we're looking at here are only those non-admitted insurance companies. So these are not insurance companies who are registered to sell insurance to Minnesotans, but instead they're using an insurance company structure to move income out of that otherwise unitary business return. The next provision deals with a mutual fund manager income. And this proposal will require all entities providing mutual fund management to apportion their income in a consistent manner based on where the mutual fund shareholders are located. Currently, if a mutual fund is managed by a corporation, then the corporation apportions its income based on where the shareholders of the mutual fund are located. But if another type of entity, such as partnership or limited liability company, manages the mutual fund, then the income is apportioned differently. It's based on where the mutual fund is located. And so to avoid the ability to set up structures that exploit this inconsistency, this proposal would treat them the same. The next provision deals with dividend received deductions from debt finance stock. And the proposal excludes dividends received from debt finance stocks when calculating the dividend received deduction. This proposal removes the unintended additional benefit to corporations which receive dividends from debt finance stock from the current statute. It also fixes an issue of dividends received from debt finance stock being included in calculating the dividend received deductions. Taxpayers currently are basically taking, you're allowed to take a deduction, of course, for the interest that you're paying on that debt finance stock and also the additional benefit of the dividend received deduction. So this is clarifying that it would only be for one, and you would reduce the amount of your dividend received deduction by a percentage based on how much of the debt is, how much of the stock is debt financed.
So, Commissioner, you can deduct the interest and the dividend from a debt finance stock?
Mr. Chairman, when you have a debt finance stock, you take the interest, and then it also can be used to claim the dividend received deduction.
That's a loophole.
Well, I mean, okay, next, please.
Mr. Chairman, I'm noting 1135.
You know, the bigger loophole, though, seriously, is that insurance companies used to shelter income. That's, you need reform on that.
Yeah. Mr.
Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Lee Marquardt.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Chair. And I know as we look at kind of this part of Article 4, these are some revenue raisers, which I know, you know, create some angst among folks. But I don't think we can dismiss this discussion out of hand, because if, in fact, you have businesses using the law for unintended benefits. You know, you talk to your folks on Main Street or other people who are, for one, you know, maybe don't have the attorneys and the accountants and the so forth, but if it wasn't intended, they're paying more. You know, I mean, these businesses who on Main Street, and you know, you're looking at like $80 million here. I mean, I think this is worthy of discussion, and I think businesses around the state should know that there are these kind of unintended benefits that certain businesses are able to take benefit that when we pass the law here, we probably were not intending it. But $80 million, for example, could get you to exempting the first $100,000 or $150,000 of value on the statewide property tax, which would benefit businesses statewide. And so I, Mr. Chair, I appreciate your comments, but I do think this is an area to take a look at and make sure we don't have these unintended benefits that other businesses really, for one reason or another, cannot take advantage of those. I think that's important. So,
And Lee Marquardt, I couldn't agree more. And just so folks know, that the discussion that we've had in the past is, my argument has been that There is no such thing as a loophole, because if it's the law and you're doing it, it's not a loophole. You can do it. But clearly, the department, we spent some time on this. The department has picked a few things here that we need to clean up. I would just say we need to clean up, because we need some reform, because there's no such thing as a loophole, but right. These come pretty close. They're not right. They're being abused, if you will. I mean, to have an insurance company to shelter money that doesn't sell insurance, mm-hmm. Really? Right. Yeah, you can do it. It's legal. But we need reform.
We agree, Mr.
Lee Marquardt?
Thank you.
Okay. Commissioner Bowery.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I'm sorry. As far as the time, we have four sessions, so we will be done at noon, but we will not necessarily be done with this bill, because I didn't want to cut members off. I didn't want to cut the department off, and I'm not going to. We're not pushing. We're not hurrying. But kind of an announcement, we're probably not going to get to a whole lot of testifiers, and we will. We're not going to be cutting anybody off on the Davids bill, Davids Marquardt bill, I might add. So just kind of so we can kind of figure, you take whatever time you need, Commissioner. We are done at noon. We will come back another day and either finish up with you and take testimony, or we'll go from there. Commissioner Bowery.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And there are just two more in this set. The next one deals with aligning federal treatment for foreign income. The proposal eliminates a tax deduction on certain foreign income under subpart F. In Minnesota, Subpart F income has been treated as a dividend that is eligible for an 80% dividend received deduction, so that only the remaining 20% is subject to tax. There is no similar practice under federal law. The entire amount is subject to tax. This proposal would disallow that income from receiving the dividend received deduction for state purposes as well. And then finally, Mr. Chairman, this would change the premium tax for non-admitted surplus lines policies purchased directly and those purchased through a broker. Under current Minnesota law, if you purchase the policy directly, it pays 2%. And about right now in Minnesota, approximately 35 taxpayers are directly procuring and pay that 3%. The remaining 1,600 are currently subject to a 3% rate because they purchase through an agent. So the proposal would align those 35 taxpayers with the 1,600 taxpayers who are currently paying a 3% rate. Mr. Chairman, this set of proposals is really about ensuring that we have fairness and consistency across Minnesota's tax laws and keeping pace with changing business trends. So the department and the governor are striving to do with this is to really find those areas that that represent disparate treatment among different taxpayers. They end some advantage tax breaks for certain types of businesses. They level the playing field for businesses across the state of Minnesota so that people are really being treated the same and not taking advantages of these what we think are unintended consequences of Minnesota law, and helps keep Minnesota tax laws keep pace with business trends. Some of them raise revenue. As I mentioned earlier, the governor's tax bill does net to $185 million in a tax reduction for the biennium. So it certainly isn't the purpose of these, wasn't to go out and raise additional revenue for the state, but they really are aimed at finding fairness and consistency across all of the different types of businesses in Minnesota. Mr. Chairman and members, the next proposal deals with modernizing rail property, and this is in that same vein of trying to ensure that Minnesota's laws are keeping pace and that we're treating all different taxpayers fairly. Minnesota's current railroad laws are outdated, and the governor is proposing to update the valuation statute and raise the levy to bring that increased revenue from the value to the local county and the state. The current methods of valuing railroad property are outdated, and this proposal would bring in modern accepted practices to value railroad property that are used in approximately 35 other states who value centralized rail property and centralized property in this way. It expands the taxable property of railroads to include rolling stock, which is personal property. Currently, there is some personal property of railroads being taxed, including docks and wharves, and this would include those as well. And these changes would be made at the state level because these are state-assessed properties, but because railroad companies also pay property taxes at local jurisdictions, those jurisdictions would often take those recommended values and can use those either to increase their levies so that the revenue can be used for needed investments or to provide property tax relief to other businesses and homeowners. This provision is one that the department has studied carefully in bringing it forward. There is a federal law that you may all be familiar with called the 4R Act that deals with the treatment of railroads, and it prohibits states from having a ratio, a rate, or a separate tax on railroads that's discriminatory relative to other entities in the same property tax base. And the department has studied that very carefully, and we believe that this is not inconsistent with the 4R Act. The personal property provisions, protection of personal property that is coming in is consistent with some of the other property taxpayers, including pipelines and airlines, where the state also taxes personal property of those entities as well. So, Mr. Chairman, I understand there are questions on this provision, so I can stop there.
I have two, Representative Grunhagen and Peter. Representative Grunhagen.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mrs. Bowerly, Commissioner Bowerly, for your testimony on this. I'm all for updating, but the way I understand, oh, by the way, when the governor proposed a tax reduction bill, early in the session, I saw it on the news. I was
mildly optimistic, but now when I look at the new taxes and fees over the next 4 years, which is close to $4 billion, and I know there's some tax reductions in there, it gives me pause, to tell you the truth. Another $4 billion out of the private sector. But anyway, be that as may. On the railroad provision, one of the things that came up the last biennium is that we needed to see these crossings upgraded and fixed for safety purposes in our community. It's hard for me to understand how we're going to do that. The railroads are going to do that when they when we're raising their taxes over the next few years another $56 million. I have a bill to address that, and I'll comment afterwards. But can't we update these laws without draining more money from the railroads in a way that actually hurts them from their ability to upgrade these railroad crossings, which are, you know, if there's a disaster with a railroad, especially carrying oil, we've seen in other states, it's a disaster that it can endanger life and property. So can we update this without removing this money from the railroad company?
Commissioner Marley?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Greenhagen, thank you. And first I will just note that the governor has other proposals that deal with rail safety, and I'm not qualified to speak to all of those, but I assume you're obviously very involved in the issue, and so we can certainly make sure that someone is in touch with you on that. With respect to the assessment practices, I hear your concern, and I think the issue is making sure that we are getting to market value, as the statute just tells us is supposed to be the goal of this assessment, and that's difficult to do without making the changes that are being proposed.
Representative Greenhagen?
Yeah, I'd be interested in visiting with the people in regards to the railroad safety. I have a bill that gives a tax credit over a period of time, up to 50% to the railroads for fixing their railroad crossings. And again, I have a difficult understanding why draining $56 million from the railroads is going to help them address the safety issues that need to be addressed in our communities. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Commissioner Bowerly?
Mr. Chair and Representative Greenhagen, I would only note that the goal of this is to get us to appropriate assessment practices, and the goal isn't to deal with the safety issues. I hear what you're saying is there, you see them as connected. I just wanted to be clear that the tax proposal is not related to that.
Representative Greenhagen?
Well, I would just say $56 million is connected to the railroad's ability to be able to fix those crossings. That's just a layperson coming to that conclusion. Thank you.
Representative Petersburg?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Commissioner, for being here. It's a big bill, and I appreciate you going through it and being prepared. My question, again, kind of relates to this and what I would consider more of the fairness. I mean, we're talking about modernizing and outdated and so forth. And my question, I guess, is currently are we charging property tax or any other kind of tax to rolling stock in the trucking industry that would be comparable to this?
Commissioner Bowerly?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Petersburg, we might have to get back to you on that. I'm not sure we have someone with us from the department who can provide a quick answer on that.
Representative Petersburg?
Thank you. I don't think we do. I mean, that's the question. Even with trucks, we do have a license or a cab fee for giving them permission to drive on our roads. But in this case, they're having their own equipment on their own tracks, and we're charging them basically a property tax is the way it looks like you're bringing this forward to us. And yet it really is personal property. We don't tax personal property and industry of the equipment without at least giving them the opportunity to depreciate it through the income tax. Property tax and property doesn't depreciate that way. And so combining it this way really doesn't seem like that's extremely fair, especially when most of the railroad cars are not owned by the railroad themselves. They're owned by individual companies. So how do we make that distinction between railroad cars and the engines that are owned by trains and so forth, and trying to make that fair and equitable? It seems to me that we're really kind of carving out this particular industry, treating it much differently in regards to property tax and so forth. Even as a farmer, I have tile underneath my farmland that I can depreciate out after a while, and yet it's permanent there. And so I'm not sure that we're really helping this particular industry, which is a key industry in this community as well, with this particular procedure. So I was curious as to what your thoughts might be on that.
Mr. Bowerly?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Piersberg, I just want to make a couple comments about the personal property piece. So under Minnesota's current practice, we do tax other personal property of, for example, pipelines and airlines. So it is not the first time that Minnesota is taxing personal property for some of the statewide assessed property. And you're right, this is in property tax. This is not in the corporate income space. So it is a different approach.
Representative Piersberg?
Yeah, thank you. And because we've done it in other locations and other things, again, this is rolling stock that goes back and forth across our state, sometimes out into other states as well. It seems to me that particular piece of property then can be multipled its tax base based upon going through other states as well, especially in the rolling stock. And it seems to me that's really not, that is quite a lot different than what we do with pipelines, in which we're only taxing the pipeline that's in our particular area. A rolling stock is going to be moving all over the place. So I do think there's a difference there, and whereas we may have done it for other industries, I don't necessarily think that's what we ought to be doing here, and so I would just caution us of pushing this forward. Thank you.
Chair Draskowski, or do you want to make a comment, Commissioner Barley?
No.
Okay, Chair Draskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, I see on page 96 and 97, you changed the base on the state general tax and increased that from the base of $592 million to $927 million. In 2019, and then you reapportion it slightly. I don't know if that was some sort of budget gymnastic there or what. I'm kind of curious, Commissioner, this is in the middle of a railroad article. Why did it appear there, and why is it not in its own article?
Commissioner Bowerly, why did I do that in the bill?
Mr. Chairman, I think we're going to have to defer to some drafters.
Mr. Cummings?
Mr. Chair, so I think part of what is being done here in terms of the drafting is it is trying to ensure that we are capturing the value related to what would happen with the railroad assessment. So if it, we thought that it would probably be inconsistent to capture that amount, I think that's $20 million or something, and then to say it would be, you know, $612 million then adjusted for inflation. We thought we would move the basis up. So no one, you know, 97.1, you're seeing that not only has the amount increased, so has the basis year, so that we're providing that. But the intention of this, Mr. Chair, is to ensure that we are not, you know, we are keeping whole all of the other CI taxpayers in the state at the rate that they're currently paying, while updating the assessment practices for our railroads, which would provide additional revenue from the state general levy in that case. Chair Draskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Cummings. I look forward to more discussion, but looks to me like you're locking in an increase in the base there. So, thank you.
Representative Hertas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and on the same issue, it would appear then, if, in fact, the property were to be levied for railroads and the state general levy applicable to it, rather than spreading the levy out amongst a broader tax base and lowering other commercial uses, it looks like you're increasing the levy to me and just raising more revenue. Quite a different direction than we've been trying to go. Thank you.
Comment?
Mr. Chair Bartlett? And Representative Hertas, the levy amount of the increase is to capture the additional revenue from the changes to the railroad assessment. It wouldn't affect the other taxpayers in that levy. Related to Chair Draskowski's question, what we've done is to update the statute to reflect the current amount of the statewide levy, and as it is, has been adjusted for inflation. We know there's a significant conversation around the statewide levy, around the inflator itself. This is the current, this is the amount that it is current, under current law, that it has been, that is reflected what is currently in the effect of that inflator over time. So we weren't trying to, we were simply trying to capture the full amount of a levy that would exist if this law were to take place.
Representative Vertos?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Commissioner Bowerly, for that clarification. So members and folks in the audience here, you can see what happens with an automatic inflator. This tax has doubled over time. Thank you.
Okay, with that, I see no more questions on the railroad. Members, if you could put the bill, put everything in the save file. We are going to start on page 13 with a provider tax extension. I want to thank the department. I want to go through this, my bill thoroughly here. And for those who wish to testify, you can stay right on the list. If there's others that wish to down the road, we don't have the date set to continue this, but this discussion will continue on the governor's proposal. Members, thank you for your work today. Good government all the time. We adjourn.